Hello and welcome to this week's Property Matters, the show that brings global industry trends to an Irish audience. You can contact us on Twitter at iPropertyRadio or by email at hello@iPropertyRadio.com. Your host today is Carol Tallon and myself, Brian Fox.
Okay, Brian, you're very welcome back.
Thank you.
After a long holiday.
Indeed, okay, break, yeah.
The main story today, obviously, Budget 2020. Pascal Donoghue was right, there were no surprises. But again, that doesn't mean it wasn't disappointing. Okay, so I suppose the big issues that are going to affect the planning, property and construction industries are stamp duty on commercial property purchases increases from 6% to 7.5%. Mm-hmm. The Help to Buy scheme, as expected, has been retained. The Construction Industry Federation has said that while it's helpful, it doesn't on its own address the affordability issues or rising construction costs, and that's something that we need to be mindful of. Also, there's a new scheme to install communal charge points for electric vehicles at apartment blocks. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And I think maybe one of the most interesting but yet unclear pieces is that in relation to the Irish Real Estate Funds and Irish Real Estate Investment Trusts, the REITs, and what's happening here is that the minister has said that this type of investment, you know, he obviously doesn't use the kind of language that we see predominantly in the media, cuckoo funds or anything like that. But this type of investment he recognises as being very welcome at this time.
This is the rental, the real estate funds
and the real estate investment trusts. So he does recognise that they're welcome and that they're necessary at this particular time and that they are important. However, he also points out that it's time that they pay an appropriate level of tax, and he doesn't go on to say what that appropriate level will be.
And what do you think? Have they not been paying an appropriate level to date yourself?
Depends on which side of the table you're on, Brian. But I would say that this is quite vague language. So he's introducing a number of new anti-avoidance measures to take effect via financial resolution this evening. So these measures are to include new limitations on interest expenses to prevent over-leveraging, a measure to combat the artificial avoidance of gains on redemption of the IREF, and also a number of targeted amendments to the Real Estate Investment Trust regime from today. So again, pretty unclear. So it would be interesting to see now the lobby group for for the institutional investors. I'm interested to see what they'll come out with about that. So again, look, no real surprises. We've yet to see what the impact of this will be. So again,
could I just talk to you just for one moment about the Help to Buy scheme, because I'm a little bit to date, he says some 15,000 new homes have been purchased or built by first-time buyers under the Help to Buy scheme in order to provide certainty to those who are hoping to buy their first home soon and to those who are planning and building those homes. I'm extending an incentive in its current form for a further period of 2 years to the end of 2021. Now, there's a lot of arguments about this in terms of it being somewhat unfair, because this scheme is designed, I think, isn't it, for people that aren't earning great money and are finding it difficult to raise a deposit. Am I wrong there?
Well, I would actually take the opposite view. I would say that in order to benefit from the maximum amount that you can benefit, you have to be earning good money, because this works as a repayment of tax paid over the previous 4 years. So in fact, it actually, for lower income earners or for people who've been working outside of Ireland and returning to Ireland, they're actually disadvantaged by this. So one of the points that has been made is that actually this benefits people, perhaps potential buyers who need it least. And there was speculation right up until yesterday evening that, you know, we knew the scheme was likely to be retained. There's been huge lobbying, and appropriately so. But there was definitely speculation that the limits, the thresholds would be reduced. Now, if they were reduced to 250,000, 300,000, that would essentially rule out most of the new homes being delivered in Dublin. And, you know, that's obviously not good.
But there is an argument that I've come across, which is sort of suggesting that it's unfair to buyers because it does benefit the certain type of buyer, and the government is subsidising that type of buyer.
Well, absolutely. It benefits potential home buyers who have been working in Ireland, and those who've been working at higher income jobs are obviously going to benefit the most to the maximum amount of relief. And I think one of the main criticisms that's levied against the Help to Buy scheme is that for people who see it as an incentive for first-time buyers, first of all, they're incorrect. This was never designed to be an incentive for first-time buyers. If you see it as that, then obviously you might not understand how it works, because it gives everybody the same advantage. All buyers who have been living and working in Dublin or in Ireland over the past 4 years, they give them the same advantage. It's really important to understand that the Help to Buy scheme is a supply side initiative. It's for the construction industry, and appropriately so. In fact, more should be done for the construction industry. But the difficulty here is a political one. It's not politically popular to come out and say we actually need to incentivise the construction industry. We need to stimulate and support the provision of home building. But that's actually what happened. So the government correctly identified that a number of years ago. They just weren't politically brave enough to say it. So in fact, if this was correctly identified as a supply side initiative, then I feel it would come under much less criticism.
I see. And what about stamp duty change? Just briefly before we go on with the programme, what's your attitude? He's decided to increase the rate of stamp duty applicable to non-residential property by 1.5% with effect from tonight.
Yeah, look, to be honest, I think that that's probably a step too far, given that in recent years it was increased from 2 to 6%. So I think that jump is too much too quickly. So I think that this year is too quickly to increase it by a further 1.5% when only in recent years it was increased from 2 to 6%.
So to sum up budget 2020 from a construction point of view, what are your thoughts?
Not particularly helpful.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But look, you know what? Actually, maybe we have more expert voice here about it, because here in studio with us today, we have Ralph Montague, architect and director of ArcDocs, board member of CETA and current chair of the NSAI Technical Mirror Committee for BIM, and part-time lecturer in Trinity. Have I left anything out, Ralph?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Well, you're very welcome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ralph, what's your take? Because obviously you're working deeply across a number of projects with the construction and across the construction industry. What's your take on this?
On the budget? Mm. Well, I suppose as you outlined there, it's pretty unimpressive. And I think the construction industry does need more support. And it's not,
getting
as you said,
it.
It's not politically correct
to do that.
But I think construction is really important to the economy, to the sector, and I'm really a fan of what you guys are doing on the show.
Thank you.
Raising sort of public discourse around construction and property matters, because obviously I think a lot of people feel disconnected from the construction and property sector as individuals It's important to everybody. It's where we live, it's where we work, it's where our kids go to school. It means everything to society. So
why do you think people are so disconnected? Because obviously we're an industry show. We talk about the planning, construction and property industry. Because I actually, what you're saying about the construction industry, I really feel like that about the planning. The planning sector, that people... Planning is a public function, yet people are so far removed from it. And I think with construction, particularly if... when people are seeing cranes in the city centre, I don't think they understand how that translates into daily life if they're living in three-bed semis in the suburbs, or, they're living in their homes and they're not currently affected by the rental crisis, or they don't need to buy a home, or their children are still in primary school, so it's not a concern. They're not thinking of student accommodation. So why? What is the disconnect?
Maybe people feel a little bit helpless in what can they do about it. But it does affect everybody, even if they don't think it affects them. I mean, we have a crisis everywhere. We have a housing crisis. We have an education crisis. We have a healthcare crisis. And that's one of the challenges of the construction industry at the moment, is a productivity issue. We can't actually produce enough infrastructure to support society, and that's not an Irish problem, actually. That's a global problem.
Who's to blame, Ralph, for that?
I don't think anyone's to blame. I think there's some demographic changes globally. There's an increase in population. There's an aging population, I think the construction industry has been a little bit slow, if you look at other sectors, in modernizing the way it works. And so, therefore, if you looked at productivity across construction for the last 40 years, there's actually been almost zero increase in productivity. Whereas if you look at productivity increases in other sectors like manufacturing or whatever, you have a 2-3 times productivity increase.
Is there an attitude then to construction in the country? What is it that's not stimulating it or encouraging it?
I suppose there's a few things. The way the construction industry is structured is it's quite fragmented. So, there's a lot of small and micro companies that make up the construction sector, and the way procurement and contracts are structured, there's a very deep sort of hierarchy of companies. So it's very difficult to organize.
But is there a policy issue here? Because I know looking at the UK, there was back in 2015 or 2016, that infamous report by Mark Farmer of Cast Consultancy, Modernise or Die, and it was such a stark call out that it got the government's attention, it got the industry's attention, it got the funders' attention. Mm. You know, have we not had a stark enough call out for the Irish sector?
Well, we've had a stark reality to our construction sector, and that's sort of manifested itself in the housing crisis and the education crisis. So, but I think the political will to do something about it has probably been slightly different in Ireland. If you look at the UK government, it came right from the cabinet office down to implement a strategy to change the way the sector works over there and to take a much more sort of productive approach, a manufacturing approach. Now, I know everybody says construction isn't manufacturing, but we can...
Why isn't it?
Well, I suppose because every project is different and bespoke, but it's not entirely true, because when you dig down into buildings, the elements that make up buildings are quite standardized.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you look at the offsite construction at the moment, certainly what we see is that actually it should be more, it should be more aligned to manufacturing, particularly with a focus on quality and consistency. Then actually, maybe this bespoke approach that we're taking is entirely the wrong one, and it is holding us back.
It's a lot of legacy, I suppose, the way the construction industry has been structured over many years, and the way people approach projects. But if you
from a corporate point of view, or
I think that's at a sector point of view. If you just did a comparison of say manufacturing, just as an example, when you're building a car or an aeroplane or whatever, the way they go about it is they would sort of design it and construct it within software first, and they would make sure all the various parts are going to fit together, and then they'd procure those parts, and you'd get to a factory floor and they would assemble it exactly the way they've designed it. And what you'd end up with is the physical product, but you'd also have this digital version of the product with all the information about it. Now, in construction, that's completely different. So the way we approach construction is we produce a set of documentation, sort of two-dimensional drawings and various other documents that describe not exactly what we want to build, but more or less what we want to build. Then we go out to procure sort of packages of work based on risk of what's not in the documentation. And the only time they begin to really work out the constructability of it is when people are on site. And that's actually the most expensive place to work things out and the most dangerous place actually is to try and figure out how we're going to build this building on site. But that's the way the construction industry works, and as a result we do eventually end up with buildings. You can't say the construction industry doesn't work. We do end up with buildings, but it's a very expensive way of
put the cart before the horse, in other words.
Well, it's an expensive way of working, and the people who have the construction experience are engaged very late in the process, so they're not bringing that sort of experience to the overall process.
So just give us an example. What sort of phase? What would other countries do? Would you go on site first and then documentation after? Or?
No. I think other countries work pretty much the same. Yeah. So this is not an Irish problem. It's a global problem that it's very paper-based. So it's very documentation-based. So the way you describe a building through architects and engineers is through sets of two-dimensional drawings that, to be honest, not many people understand how to read. Yeah. And and because it's paper-based information, it's very slow to process and very slow to update if changes
and
occur.
I presume potential confusion over updates, and then obviously you can have overlap or clashes, and that's one of the big problems on site for traditional build.
And there's terrible statistics. I mean, 70% of construction projects end up over time or over budget or both. that's quite a high failure rate, and
that costs money.
Yeah, and then because you're changing on site, you're wasting a lot of material, a lot of labor. So the waste factor in construction is said to be over 30%. Some organizations would say it's almost 40-50% of the cost of construction is wasted effort, wasted material. Yeah,
that's outrageous given the tiny margins at the moment.
Absolutely.
But from what you're saying, then, are we looking at a procurement problem?
Procurement is definitely one of the problems, because the way we procure, as I said earlier, we sort of procure these sort of packages of risk without really fully worked out what we're going to do, and we're only working it out when we're on site and we're engaging with the construction professionals at a very late stage.
And that
sort of approach to procurement is very old-fashioned.
Is there a difference between the public and private sector for that?
Not particularly. I think the government contracts in Ireland sort of try to mitigate risk by pushing the risk onto contractors, but that's backfired in a way that if the quality of the information you're producing during the design stage is still not fully worked out, then that opens up opportunities for contractors to rightfully, like, you can't blame them, to claim for variations and extensions of time where they have to work out things at a later stage. And so you've seen it. Anybody who's been involved in the construction of buildings knows that it always goes wrong. There's no perfect project. So I think what we need to do in construction is step back and say, well, why don't we approach this like they do in manufacturing? And I think that's where technology and building information modeling sort of offers opportunity, because we can construct a building now in software before we ever get to site. We can work it out fully, coordinate it, work out the price, work out the logistics of how we're going to put stuff together within software, which is a very cheap place to do that, a very safe place to do it, because you're not hurting anyone, you're not killing anyone. Mm-hmm. and then once you've done, like in manufacturing, once you've figured that out, you can go to site and execute what you've done and avoid all those cost overruns and waste.
Is BIM being used? So say in the UK, we know that BIM is mandatory in all PPP projects since 2016. Where are we in Ireland?
In Ireland, there is a government policy. So in 2017, the Government Contracts Committee announced that they would implement a strategy to mandate BIM over a three-year period, starting in 2019 with complex projects and then medium projects and simple projects. So they have
Who decides if a project, public project, is complex?
The procuring authority. So the Government Contracts Committee sort of involved with all the major procuring authorities like the TII, HSE, the Department of Education, and they still have to go and procure the buildings, and I suppose they amongst themselves are deciding.
Is the public or private sector leading the charge here in terms of BIM adoption?
I would say so, yes. A lot of the international clients...
Private.
Yeah. A lot of the international clients, the big FDI clients, are obviously advanced in this way of thinking, and they sort of demanding that of their delivery teams.
But it's really customer-led.
It should be customer-led. So because it's the old golden rule, you know, he who has the gold makes the rules. You know, and but unfortunately, and this is one of the biggest excuses that people are using for not implementing BIM, is that they say our clients are not asking for it. And, you know, I think that's a little bit of a cop-out, because, you know, if I go for professional advice to a doctor, I don't he doesn't expect me to tell him how to do his job. Same with a lawyer or an accountant. You know, you're expecting the professional advisors to give you the best advice as a client. And, I think a lot of professionals in the industry are using the fact that clients are not asking for BIM as a way not to
stay with us, because we're going to to this conversation, the next part, very interesting. Ralph Monarch of
Montague,
excuse me, of Architects, stay with us, because we're going to continue this conversation. Meanwhile, we take a break. And you're very welcome back to Property Matters here in Dublin South FM with Carol Tull and myself, Brian Fox. You can contact us on Twitter at iProperty Radio or at email at iPropertyRadio.com. Before the break, we're talking to Ralph Montague of RDux. So let's just move on, because what I want to ask you, Ralph, is we talked there about construction, the digital transition of structure sector. Tell us something about that, would you?
Yeah, well, McKinsey did an interesting report about productivity in different sectors, and they measured construction was actually the second least digitized sector in
what's the least digitized sector?
I think it was fishing or hunting. You know, so and when you look at other sectors, digitization has brought about significant productivity improvements. You know, so that's what's driving, I suppose, the digital transition. And
why the reluctance?
From who?
From the construction industry that are so slow to take it up, the second least.
Yeah, well, and I think it comes back to what I said earlier. Like the industry is very fragmented, and when somebody says, "Well, we should do digital," they sort of push the requirement onto small SMEs down at the other end of the supply chain, rather than trying to look at it in a structured manner. So I think Enterprise Ireland put a group of industry leaders together called the National BIM Council, and the role of the council was to write a strategy document to inform government of how we should approach the digital transition of construction in Ireland, and that was released in 2017. Now, unfortunately, not much has happened since then, but in the public eye. But I suppose in the background, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform have been discussing this and trying to work out how they would implement that. But I mean, what applies to the sector applies equally well to individual companies. That if you want to transform the way you do business and sort of make big productivity improvements and therefore profitability and all the good stuff that goes with that, you need strong leadership. You know, you need leaders in industry who are willing to say we have to change the way we do things. Yes, we can build.
Is that there?
In some pockets, I wouldn't say it's generally there. I think some people have developed business models over the years which are predicated on the way we work and wasteful way we work. And
is part of the problem, though, that we had a decade of pure chaotic crisis, and then even as we came out of that, the recovery was chaotic. The margins, just they didn't seem to increase as activity increased, and now we're very clearly on a downward slope again. So it feels like maybe there's never the right time to bite the bullet with this. You know, there is a cost implication, there is an upskilling implication. Is that part of the problem, that we just don't seem to have had a long enough period of stability that we could depend on?
It's part of the problem, but it's more of a misunderstanding, because the digital transition is about improving productivity and not making things more expensive, but making them cheaper and making them easier. So, you know, yes, there's investment required into digital tools and upskilling, but that has to be offset about the gains you're going to make, even as an individual business.
So, are
they afraid of
the expense that I'm investing in software and hardware in relation to it?
Well, in In relative terms, no, because the most expensive part of the construction industry is labor.
Yeah.
So if you force our labor to use outdated practices or paper-based practices, that's costing money. And if you can equip the labor with digital tools that allows them to be more productive and produce more output, well, then that saves you money. So,
but do you think having individual construction companies are small individual construction, have they identified this as a problem and are open to suggestions in relation to moving forward on this?
I think if you sit down with people and talk to them about this issue, they'd get it. But you know, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there, and there's people going around saying that BIM is going to cost more and it's going to it's going to take more time, and that's absolutely not true.
Like, do we have actually case studies here? Do we have things that we can look at and point to and say, okay, well, look, on this particular project, BIM achieved, whether it was a savings, whether it was a certainty of program, whether it was, do we have something we can point to and say, well, actually, this works, and here I can show you.
So the Construction IT Alliance was charged by Enterprise Ireland and the National BIM Council to carry out a number of case studies and produce two reports. So they produced a report to look at the global adoption of BIM and where our island sat in that, and then they looked at the Irish sort of sector's adoption of BIM and produced two reports which informed the work that the National BIM Council was doing in terms of writing the strategy. So okay, that's all available.
Can I just backtrack there for a second and maybe ask, where does Ireland sit in terms of global adoption?
Well, we're not leaders. Let's just say that. But we're not complete laggards either. So I suppose we're somewhere in between. I think Ireland has the potential to be a leader because we're a small market, and we're very agile in terms of most people know each other. And if we made a decision as a country that we're going to become good at what we're doing in terms of digital adoption, that could happen a lot quicker than, the UK.
Are we seeing pockets of this in the industry? So, for example, like we've had a special here on data centres, and there's an industry that's using this very well. Same thing for logistics centres, same thing for whether it's for retail. So there are definitely pockets of this sector that are doing this better.
There's some companies in Ireland that are doing this incredibly well, and
they are leaders.
Yeah, but that doesn't represent the industry. So, if you looked at the sector, about 95% of the sector are SMEs. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, a lot of them may have never heard of BIM. And particularly when you get to the sectors where we're struggling, which is housing, primary schools, primary healthcare. It's not the big companies that are focusing on that unless it's through a PPP package. But so it's that sort of medium tier part of the sector we need to get to. And
I presume there's an element of actually getting to the next generation of our design and build teams. So I know...
Well, that's actually... Ireland is doing quite well in that regard. So the education system in terms of training...
Can I ask you, Ralph, just as a matter of interest, if there's a major project going on, there's a lot of money going into, a lot of public money going into, say, the Children's Hospital, just for example, it's a bad example to give to you, that's going up at the moment, would it not be incumbent on the government to insist on all that are involved with the construction to have a look at what you're talking about?
Well,
They have
that particular project, that there's a BIM requirement to deliver that project through BIM.
And what's gone wrong?
Well, in a way, you could say it BIM has worked because they've found a lot of issues before they've even come out of the ground.
But should we have done that at an earlier stage? Is this where we need to look at procurement?
Yeah. They should have completed the exercise before they went to tender, before they signed a contract.
Well, this is my point.
Yeah.
This is my point, in that Office of Public Work, the government itself, should sort of say, look, guys, this is in vogue now at the moment. This is very, very cost efficient. This is the process we've got to go through in future.
Yeah. And I suppose the government, through their sort of policy that they announced in 2017, have sort of indicated that commitment.
But it's more imposing it than indicating it.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Well, they have to impose it through the various procurement authorities that operate under the Government Contracts Committee, and and to be fair, there's an upskilling required at that level as well. So, I think the whole industry needs to raise its game in terms of understanding.
You know, this is really bringing to mind the cargo ship or the tanker out in the ocean. You know, it's the decision has been made. It's just taking a long time turning. And that seems to be kind of the frustration at the moment. So, okay, government, they're aware of this. Mm. Policymakers are providing forward. It's just the impact on the ground just seems to be taking a long time to translate.
Yeah. And this is where the misunderstanding is coming, because when we talk to people and say, well, this is a no-brainer, why aren't you working this way? It's saving money, it's saving time, it's saving people's lives, it's helping the sort of environmental impact. The number one excuse we get from most companies is our clients are not asking us to do this.
Yeah.
And, as I was saying earlier, I think that's a bit of a professional cop-out. You should say, well, I'm the professional and I should be telling our clients this is the way we should be working. And
so then it's a case of establishing best practice or, really having this exemplar within the sector that people can point to and learn from. And I know that that's something that you're trying to do with AEC Hive.
Yeah.
What is AEC Hive?
Okay, so what we find in construction is there's very little research and innovation. It's happening, but it's happening sort of in individual companies and on a project level. And the sort of outcomes and the learnings never sort of come out into the industry. And whereas if you look at other sectors like healthcare or medical devices or ICT, whatever, there's incredible amounts of innovation and research happening in Ireland. So Ireland's actually doing quite well as a knowledge economy in a lot of those sectors. So what we're trying to do with this event is sort of engage people in the construction sector in sort of coming together, because there's incredible people in the industry with a lot of knowledge, to engage them, to bring them together and begin to try things in a safe environment, to do some research, to do some innovation. So it's kind of a hackathon type event where people will set up little groups, define their own sort of challenge that they want to meet, prepare for the event and come together on a weekend in November.
Are these corporate teams or can individuals come along?
Well, individuals can come along, but we want people to collaborate. So you wouldn't come along as an individual. You would try and find two or three individuals.
But can you come along and actually find a team there?
Well, so the traditional hackathon model would be that. But I suppose what we found with those models is that you don't get a lot done if you have to sort of gel with people on the day and get something done. So what we encouraging people is to form groups beforehand and even prepare a little bit amongst themselves.
I think you're underestimating the honeymoon period, Ralph. I found with teams that actually the first 24 hours are probably the most polite and productive that you can get. But no, I take your point.
Yeah.
So what kind of projects do you want to see, or what kind of problems do you want to see come up at that?
Well, there's a lot of problems, I suppose, in the construction sector.
It's a rich fishing pool.
And a lot of innovation. And, if you look at the investment that's going into research and development, construction, again, is on the very bottom tier. So there's enough problems. So I think people will define their own problems within their sector.
Talking about problems, I'm just curious on this one, because when I was a lot younger, there was an attitude where Fianna Fáil, I'm getting politically here, but it's a cultural thing as well, I think, we're seen to be very, very good to the construction industry. And then Fianna Fáil sort of got this reputation where if you voted them in, they'd be having sites all over the place. So people got kind of cynical of Fianna Fáil because then it was construction everywhere, construction and public service. Is that attitude there, do you think? I know you've been in the country now a good number of years.
Decades.
But from the point of view of someone that's been living here and has heard this attitude at a younger age, I don't hear it so much now. Is that part of the cultural stigma, perhaps? Is that the right word attached to the whole problem?
Possibly. I don't think construction as a sector is getting the support it needs.
From any political party?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. There's a research centre for advanced manufacturing in Limerick that gets 46 million euros a year, I heard the other day. There's a research centre in Ireland for web content, but there's no research centre that deals with innovation in construction. So, you know, and that's one of the recommendations we made in the roadmap, was that construction represents about 10% of our GDP. You know, we're spending 20 billion euros a year on construction. The government's spending at least 8 billion euros a year.
So is this something for Owen Murphy to look at? No, I'm quite serious.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was the recommendations that, because it's so fragmented, to expect all the little SMEs around the country to come up with the answers and the innovation individually is crazy. The sector really needs to come together.
I don't actually think it's crazy to expect them to come up with the answers, because I actually think that's generally where the answers do come from. I think what's crazy is that we're not harnessing that. We're not collecting it. But actually, I do think a lot of the answers come from there. We just don't know about it. Brian, as to your point on corruption by another name, I actually was having a discussion with a property developer only in the last 2 weeks. And he's pointed out to me that actually there are many forms of corruption, and a mismatch between state policy and how it's enforced is a form of corruption. And I thought that was a very good point to make, because we actually have a policy established, and yet, you know, particularly kind of on the planning side, and yet maybe not being implemented on the ground at local authority stage because of political interference. And that's a form of corruption. So I think it's really important that we take, you know, if we're going to go down that road, that we take a very comprehensive view, though, and look at the full spectrum, because I do think, you know, that old style of thinking is, you know, it has tarnished the industry. And I think it's particularly unhelpful at a time when trust is such an important, it's such an important piece of the jigsaw here. And it's not just the industry needs to trust government, not just to make the legislation, but to enforce it and to support the industry, and that's not happening.
Well, I think there's
also
a mistrust between the consumer and the industry as well, I think.
There's a bit of a connecting of the dots
ways.
I think there's a huge disconnect amongst the different, we started. So on the one hand, the government's saying we have a policy that we want to implement digital processes, but then they have a planning system that the only way you can make a submission is through 10 printed copies of the documents. You've said this before, Carol, that the public look at drawings and they're not trained to look at drawings, so there's an immediate distrust of what's being proposed,
it's a kind of a vicious circle going down and around.
So
all the time, isn't it?
So there has to be a connecting of the dots across the whole spectrum, from planning to design
and
to construction,
this
to the way we...
This is where a centre of excellence would pull all of these things in together, you know. But, you know, actually a huge amount of this comes back to being more thoughtful in terms of the whole user experience and user experience design, pulling that all in. And by coincidence, our next guest this evening is actually going to talk to us exactly about that. So Ralph, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for giving us your time and your insights into this, because it's something that as an industry we need to get to grips with. So that was Ralph Montague of ArcDocs. Thank you so much for being with us today. Stay tuned after the break. We'll be joined by Angela Shoiga to explain the fundamentals of UX design, or really designing for optimum user experience for prop tech, and why it's important. So stay tuned.
You're very welcome back to Property Matters here in Dublin South FM with Carol Tan and myself, Brian Fox. So now in studio is Angela Shoiga to explain the fundamentals of UX, our user experience design. Angela, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. So tell us, what exactly is user experience design?
Well, basically, user experience sounds very jargony, but it's been around for a long time. So basically, what it is it centres every interaction that a user has with any service or any product. So I actually, when I'm trying to explain it to people, I actually bring it back to kind of a building analogy, because people tend to understand that. So So basically, when you're building a house, you have your architect and you have your construction team, and then you either have a painter or an interior designer. Mm-hmm. So basically, a UX designer would be the architect of any application or system. So basically, in order to have a solid foundation and a solid structure, you need to have good
that
UX
goes
design.
On the paper.
That goes on the paper, goes into your planning meetings. You were talking about pre-planning and making everything efficient and as high a quality as possible before it goes further. A UX designer does that for any system and tries to get rid of any friction points or any pain points or any bugs before going to development. And as in construction, labour is most expensive, and then development in developing an application is most expensive.
So it's a type of software?
It's not really. UX design really is based solely around your user and what's best for your user. So you're trying to make everything, it's not necessarily what they need, but it's not necessarily what they want, but it's more what they need. So you as a UX designer have to kind of take on kind of a few different hats. You're kind of a psychologist in some respects when you're doing your user testing, and then you have to iterate through kind of different solutions depending on different what the problem is, who your user groups are. So it's kind of, I suppose, it's a bit of an holistic approach kind of to design. So it covers kind of the technical, but it also is very much focused on your user.
Okay, and can you give us some examples of, you know, what would be considered great UX design?
I suppose the one that probably everybody knows is Spotify at this stage, and if they don't know themselves, they're probably familiar with it. Since Spotify's come on the scene, they've really taken over from the likes of iTunes.
Why is that, actually? I mean, to be honest, my daughter set it up on my phone. I'm showing my age now. She set it up phone because she discovered I had the same playlist.
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is. That is down to their UX.
Yeah.
They have done, over the years, they have invested a lot into user research, and they've also used a lot of data that they have in the background to I suppose, to tailor it to their user, like personalization. Like,
well, let's talk about Spotify now, because it's an app on the phone, right?
Yeah.
And I have my various genres of music that I like to listen to, right?
Yeah.
So I can pick and choose my genres. So how does that apply then from the technical point of view? You know, and then you can flip over if you don't like the particular track you're listening to.
Yeah. Well, it all really boils down to convenience and usability. Like, I have switched to other, we'll just stick with the music analogy for now.
Yeah,
like, I've switched to other music apps and they're not as intuitive. Like,
is that right? Yeah.
Is intuitive the magic word there?
It is in terms of Spotify. Yeah, their information architecture in the background and their algorithms are really, they're so intelligent. Like, they're so, and they're introducing new features all of the time, and they're making subtle changes that their user doesn't realise they're making. Like, other applications, like, again, it's not a property one, but Snapchat a couple of years ago made a huge change to their UX and their UI of their application, and they lost thousands of users, where Spotify has kind of implemented things and tested it with small user groups.
Okay.
And as it's been successful, then
if that's an example of good UX, can you tell us an example of really poor UX?
I would be a big fan of audiobooks and podcasts. So one of the apps that I use is Audible, which is powered by Amazon, huge tech company. And the user experience is so that you actually have to leave the application, go to their mobile website if you want to buy audiobooks. So it's not making it convenient for the user. It's not intuitive.
Yeah.
You're wasting a lot of time. And as a result, the bottom line is you're going to lose custom from that. And that's what all this boils down to, is that if your customers aren't happy, or if your purchasers are unhappy, then they're not going to recommend your product to your friend, or, you know, you might fail to retain them.
Every episode of Property Matters here, you know, we generally have a prop tech startup, so somebody who's innovating for the planning, construction, property industry, usually bringing in new tools and technology. So we have them in most weeks, and, you know, there's always a focus on the problem that they're trying to solve, but I never really hear a focus on how consumers might want to use this, and also do you think there's a lot of assumptions being made? So, you know, okay, we're targeting, we're identifying a problem and mm-hmm. startups are identifying yeah. a problem. Do you think they're understanding enough how the users want to see this problem solved as opposed to just, okay, we're solving this problem?
In terms of the property industry, I don't think so. I think there are a lot of assumptions being made. I don't think that, you know, there are problems identified, but they're not identified in as specific as a way as you would need in terms of developing successful technology to solve that problem. Like, say, for instance, like examples of good prop tech would be like your heat miser technology, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. There's a lot of other products out there at the moment for, say, you know, managing your tenants and that they can log on and that they can report if there's a leak or. But a lot of these platforms are not intuitive. They're not, you know, they're not going back to the user to figure out.
You're trying to bring this into the market now yourself, this type of intuitive type of.
Yeah, well, that would be the centre kind of UX design. And I would see kind of, I suppose, property is, as Ralph said, is a slow adopter kind of to the digital transformation.
Does that make that industry very attractive to you as a UX designer because there's so much potential, you know, as opposed to...
And there's so many, fundamentally, there's so many users, there's so many problems out there to solve. Yeah.
That's so interesting. You're the second guest to sit in that chair this evening and say there are so many problems.
You then see these applications, you see the problems. How do you go about rectifying it, should we say? I mean, do you talk to the people that are involved with
It depends on, like, it's one thing identifying your problem, but you have to identify who that's a problem for.
Exactly.
So, like, say, if you take a residential purchaser, like, you have your first-time buyers, you have your trader-uppers, your trader-downers. Each of those, you have to make your product then that it would be at a certain level that each of those would be able to step through whatever process that they want. Like, say, new developments that would have a mixture of first-time buyers and trader downers, for example. But if you're going to implement a tenant management system, it needs to be accessible to all of your tenants. You can't just do something that mirrors, say, like some of the popular apps like Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah.
You need to do something that minimises the amount of kind of cognitive impact on your users.
Okay, look, the reality is that actually prop tech in Ireland, and actually not just prop tech, property offerings, full stop, they're coming off a low base. So, yes, estate agents would always say that the consumer, but really they mean their client, is at the centre of what they do. The reality is, you know, the platforms, the leading platforms, the sales portals we have at the moment, they're not great,
mm-hmm.
but there's no competition to them. So I see with a lot of the new technologies that are being offered, you know, because they're innovative in what they're doing, there's no competition or very little competition.
Yeah.
So are we in danger of almost accepting pretty poor UX in prop tech purely because it's new?
Yeah, like I think really one of the fundamental things with UX and property is that a lot of time the new technology is used or the, like say for marketing, a lot of the kind of 360 tours and the virtuality, which is fine, but it's the thing with UX, you don't have to necessarily adopt the most shiny thing for actually to be the best solution. Like the first solution is very seldom the best solution. Like, for example, like there's a lot of areas out there like that could be in property that could be improved for your very basic user. Like, and there's a lot of, like every company now understands kind of data-driven decisions, and there's a lot of data in property that's not been fed back into the pipeline to improve not only for your purchasers, but also for the construction industry. We're talking about kind of reducing environmental waste. We're talking about increasing getting rid of our diesel and petrol engines in favour of electric cars. Like, consumers want to have the same insights into how much is this going to cost me? How am I going to manage this? If I get an electric car, how much is this going to add to my... For example, so that's another area of prop tech kind of... Yeah. Like, the area is quite vast.
But consumers across, you know, step outside of property, consumers full stop. Today, and I'm not talking about millennials, I mean consumers of all age groups now are just more demanding than they have been in the past. And yet, for some reason, we seem to excuse a lesser offering from property.
Yeah.
Why is that? I mean, on a sales point of view, I know that one of the reasons we're given for that is because it's such an infrequent transaction. So people put up with 3 months delays of conveyancing for something that could be done like a bank transaction.
Yeah.
So are we, you know, I again, we're coming off a low base.
I suppose because it's such an infrequent transaction, people do put up with a lot more, and people, you know, for most people it's the biggest purchase if they're buying a house.
Buying the house, yeah.
It's the biggest purchase they're going to make in their life, and they want to make sure that, you know, they understand structurally they want it to be okay, and that the legal documentation. So people sometimes don't mind that if it takes a bit of extra time, but they get it right, then it's fine. They don't necessarily, they're not as demanding as they would be in every other area. Like, I look at how the banking industry has transformed in recent years, and if you look at the likes of Revolut and how easy it is now to open an account with them as opposed to like opening with your traditional bank, you know. And you know, property probably should be heading in the same direction as that and making things easier for all of their consumers.
Well, I suppose the positive takeaway from that is that, you know, fintech is far more established, but prop tech is coming after that. I think that this is something that we're going to return to again as we see prop tech becoming more evolved. But for now, thank you so much. That was UX designer Angela Shoiga. Thank you so much for joining us. I know we're going to revisit this topic again as we progress, but that's it from us in studio today. Thank you so much for being with us on Property Matters, the show where property matters. Get in touch with the show by emailing hello@iPropertyRadio.com or on Twitter @iPropertyRadio. We'd like to thank our guests for joining us here today. Also, thanks to Danny Hickey on sound. We're back at the same time next week. From Brian Fox and myself, Carol Tallon, have a great week.